Broadcasting from Edinburgh, Scotland, you're listening to World in Focus on Radio Sputnik
with Jack Foster and Carolyn Scott.
Thank you, Jay. Coming up on today's programme, 41 Tibetan refugees attempt to flee from Chinese-controlled Tibet into India via Nepal have been detained at the border by Nepali police, according to official reports. The refugees now face repatriation to China, but human rights groups argue that this has more to do with pressure for Chinese authorities than of immigration law.
The upcoming French elections take another interesting twist as former investment banker and former economic minister to President François Hollande, Emmanuel Macron, announces that he will be running for French presidency under the banner of his new political movement, En Marche.
Peru is now midway through its hosting of the annual APEC summit, and with talks reportedly taking place between Lima and Beijing over the long-anticipated RCEP partnership, we were looking at the future of free trade in the Asia-Pacific now that the US is sounding more and more like it's going to step back from such treaties in the wake of Donald Trump's victory.
Kenyan officials have today announced that they will extend the closure of the Dadaab refugee camp by 6 months, but human rights groups are reporting that Kenyan officials are forcing refugees out of the world's largest refugee camps in an attempt to speed up the repatriation programmes.
A new poll shows that 72% of Brits believe that social media groups such as Facebook should have to take responsibility to prevent the spread of misinformation or fake news. This follows allegations that the spread of fake news stories is having a huge influence on political campaigns and elections.
And great art is always controversial. That's the statement of a man who spent 7 hours getting a tattoo of a rather controversial figure.
All that and more over the next hour on this Wednesday edition of World in Focus. 41 Tibetans attempting to cross the border into India via Nepal have been detained by Nepali police. That's according to official reports on Monday. Those detained are refugees fleeing Chinese-controlled Tibet, and they're following in the footsteps of many thousands like them ever since China's incorporation of Tibet into its territory in 1951. The most high-profile Tibetan exile now living in India being, of course, the Dalai Lama.
The numbers of people embarking on the difficult journey through dangerous mountain passes has waned in more recent years, but is still in the hundreds. And despite Nepal's policy of neutrality with neighbouring China, specifically with regards to Tibet, huge numbers of refugees are able to pass through a well-worn route to India. The Tibetans, who were not carrying any documentation, have now been handed over to immigration authorities and look likely to be sent back to China, though human rights groups such as Human Rights Watch have argued that the action has more to do with pressure from China than immigration law.
Shubhash Gumir is the editor of Republica, and he joins me on the line now from Kathmandu. Thanks for speaking with us today, Mr. Gumir. How unusual is this situation? I mean, Nepal isn't under any obligation to recognise refugees fleeing Tibet, and it maintains a fractious neutrality policy with China. This surely can't be the first time that Tibetans have been threatened with repatriation to China.
Yeah, this is not the first time, but this comes at a time when major national dailies, including ourselves, we actually broke the story last week that one of our former prime ministers, Mr. Sir Bahadur Deva, was in India, in Goa, at a conference, and he was said to have met with a Tibetan prime minister. And that news came here in Kathmandu as a shockwave, and then we printed the photograph of him sitting alongside with the Tibetan prime minister. And a lot of people viewed that as going against our long-held tradition of one China policy. So I think this move comes right after that, and I think they want to showcase to China that, you know, we are still committed to one China policy and there's nothing that will stop us from recommitting to that commitment.
So given what you've just said there, realistically, if we take into account the huge numbers of refugees that have passed through Nepal over the years, this situation, given the timing, is not just a straightforward no documents immigration issue. It's about China-Nepal relations.
Absolutely. I mean, the particular route that the refugees use from India to go to Tibet is very common, and it almost happens on a regular basis in small numbers. So this was a particular situation that developed after this incident in India. And you also have to recognize the fact that there are a lot of refugees that are actually residing in Kathmandu since the 60s. We have more than 50,000 refugees that have been living here for a long time. We used to grant them a work permit, which we no longer do. We stopped after the 90s.
Is it safe to assume that this is a temporary reaction to recent political events, or does this actually signal a sea change in the way that Nepal is going to deal with Tibetan refugees?
Well, I would think this is a temporary reaction, but I think moving forward, we have to be really careful about how we deal with China. I think they're very sensitive. Their influence in Nepal over the years have grown by many folds. The development projects and their involvement in Nepal has grown so much, and it's very visible in Nepal. So I think we have to be really mindful of our unique geography. I think a lot of people do recognize here in Nepal that that is the only reason why we've had a very good relations with China, you know, since the 50s.
What about these refugees? I mean, what is waiting for them if they are sent back to China?
We actually have no information about that. They might be interrogated for a while, but we have no information as such. They might be able to, you know, go back to their villages in Tibet or somewhere else. I mean, we you know, hardly get any information once they are deported from here.
Presumably, it's likely that they will try to make the crossing again.
Yeah, I think that happens on a regular basis from along the Nepal-India border. So this is not new. I think, you know, but this is a reaction, and I think the border security will be loosened in coming days.
Well, Subhash Kumar, thank you very much for talking to us today.
Thank you. Good talking to you.
Former French investment banker Emmanuel Macron has today announced that he will be running for the French presidency. Macron served as the economy minister for President François Hollande's government, but resigned earlier this year to launch his own political movement called En Marche, which translates to English as simply Forward. There has already been much speculation over the upcoming French presidential elections, especially given the results of the US presidential elections and the UK's Brexit vote. Macron's announcement today throws a spanner in the works for both the left and right of centre candidates.
The Republicans will select their candidate on Sunday at their presidential primaries, with a potential runoff vote the following Sunday, 27th of November. If no candidate secures at least 50% of the vote, the current favourite to take the Republican nomination is Alain Juppé. Juppé has decades of experience of working within the government as a minister covering several portfolios, and also served as the Prime Minister from 1995 to 97. Yet while Juppé is doing well in the polls, he is up against tough competition for the Republican candidacy in former President Nicolas Sarkozy.
The Socialists will not hold their primaries until January, however, and it remains to be seen if incumbent President François Hollande will stand for re-election. The Socialist primaries mark the first time in over 50 years that an incumbent president would have to vie for candidacy. The current Prime Minister, Manuel Valls, has been suggested as a potential strong candidate who polls well with Socialist voters, but has yet to announce his intention to stand. But the rise in support for far-right Front National candidate Marine Le Pen, and now the announcement by Emmanuel Macron, could deliver a blow to the traditional two-party divide, especially in the current climate. While Macron served as economy minister for Hollande, he was not an elected official, and his background in business and banking rather than political office could attract the anti-establishment vote. Joining me on the line to discuss this further is Dr. Paul Smith, Associate Professor and Head of Department of French and Francophone Studies at the University of Nottingham. Dr. Smith, thank you for joining us today. Does Macron's announcement and the rising support for Marine Le Pen divide the traditional Republican-Socialist split?
To some extent, yes. But I think what's going to happen this time round in the election is that the left, Macron will undermine the left to a certain extent, but we're not really going to see a contest between the left and the right this time, but between the right and the extreme right.
And, well, 2016 has been an eventful year for establishment politics. Macron's not an elected official. He's seen as being good for business. He's a businessman. Could he replicate the success of Donald Trump in that regard by reaching out to the anti-establishment vote?
Not in quite the same way. Le Pen, of course, has always cast herself as the anti-establishment vote. I think what Macron will try to do, what he is trying to do, is locate himself as somebody who actually bridges the centre-right and the centre-left, so that although he's been in the government with Valls and Hollande, he can actually reach out across the divide between the centre-right and the centre-left, bring in people from the centre-right who might be feeling rather anxious about the danger, not just of a Le Pen candidature, but also of Nicolas Sarkozy. And that's where his real Bloomfield constituency sit. So, yes, he's a new man in some ways, but he wants to be new in a different way to Donald Trump. He's not cut from the same cloth.
And you mentioned Sarkozy there, and the Republican primaries kick off on Sunday. Do you think that Sarkozy has a chance, or many people suggest that Alain Juppé is now the favourite to take the candidacy there?
The big problem for Alain Juppé is that it is going to be if not many people actually turn out to vote, because as I'm sure you know, this is a voluntary thing. You know, people have to pay to be entitled to vote in the primary. So it's a minimum fee. It's about €2. But the idea is that you sign up to a series of values. And the big problem will be for Juppé that it may be that people who, in opinion polls, have expressed a desire to vote for him might actually, you know, not bother. Whereas Sarkozy has the party behind him. Les Républicains are pretty much solid behind him. So there is a possibility, although it looks in the opinion polls as if Juppé is way out in the lead. In fact, his electorate really looks quite volatile, and there's a possibility that he will not do as well on Sunday as he might have hoped. Now, of course, in the second round, if he gets through to the second round with Sarkozy, there's an awful lot of voters and many of the other candidates who will ask their voters to vote for Juppé. But I think we could be surprised by how well Sarkozy does on Sunday.
To look at the Socialists, their primaries won't happen until January, but this is the first time that they've even held primaries for an incumbent president in around 50 years, I believe. Is the fact that they're even holding these primaries, does it show a lack of confidence in President Hollande?
Oh, yes, absolutely. I mean, you know, you would not expect the incumbent to have to present themselves again, but that's absolutely what it is, that Hollande, you know, I mean, many people in the Socialist Party feel he should fall on his sword anyway. He hasn't formally announced whether he's going to stand, and he's not going to announce that until December. That's one of the reasons that Macron has made his announcement today. But yes, absolutely, it's not at all usual, and it really is. The Socialist Party don't feel confident about Hollande at all.
And one potential candidate who has not yet said, and obviously won't until December, say if he will run for the Socialist candidacy is the current Prime Minister, Manuel Valls. Now, some polling from October shows amongst Socialist voters, he polls much higher than Macron and the other contenders for the Socialist candidacy. What do you think the chances are of the current Prime Minister stepping up to try and bid for a position?
I think it's a very strong possibility. His problem is Arnaud Montebourg, who has already announced that he's going to be a candidate, but within the Socialist primary. But if it does stand, then it's a very strong candidature from within the Socialist Party. The Socialist voters, and certainly the party itself, doesn't like disloyalty, and it doesn't like Macron much because of the reasons you just mentioned, that he's never been elected. He hasn't come through the system, as it were. So they would see Valls as being kind of their candidate. But what Valls and Macron and Montebourg, I think, are really looking forward to is not 2017. They're really looking to 2022 for the next presidential election in France. So they're kind of thinking forward, because I think that although they will make all the right noises, they know that 2017 is a busted flush.
And we can talk about polling among Socialist voters and what the Republican voters, who they think their best candidates would be, but these elections are won and lost on the undecided voters and the voters in the margins, and this year has perhaps seen some rather shock results with the Brexit vote and with Trump's presidency. Now, are we looking at a similar situation here? Do you think there's a rise in anti-establishment rhetoric that will really make this a battle between the likes of Le Pen and Macron?
Well, I think certainly with Le Pen, I think it's an absolute certainty almost, insofar as what these things can be certain, that she will get through to the second round. And everybody in France is thinking that it's a question of, and this is where academics and journalists are kind of playing with ideas about what might happen with the primaries for the right, with, you know, who goes through, if Sarkozy goes through after this primary, what happens in a contest with Le Pen, how will left-wing voters vote? The bottom line is that pretty much everybody has agreed that there is a solid 30% of voters in France now who will back Le Pen, and so clearly driven by an anti-establishment rhetoric. The problem for Macron is there isn't the space for him. There is another left-wing candidate, a man called Mélenchon, who's kind of the hard left. He's outside of the Socialist Party, and he at the moment is polling 10 to 15%. If you take that away, plus the 30% for the right and 30% for Marine Le Pen, that's not leaving an awful lot of space place for Macron to occupy. So it's difficult to see him rallying the anti-establishment at this point, but one can see him going or pushing on from there to do something else. I mean, that's what I think he wants to do, is to try and break the Parti Socialiste, but also to undermine the centre in French politics, which has tended to, in the past, vote to the right, but which is very antithetical towards Sarkozy.
And I guess just finally, as we watch on as anti-establishment candidates seem to gain support, you can't get more establishment than a former president in Sarkozy and the current prime minister in Valls, can you, really?
No, absolutely. I mean, that's quite right. One of the reasons that Sarkozy failed in 2012 is that he failed to hang on to one of the great hopes we had in 2007 was that Sarkozy had actually grabbed back the far-right voters, the people who'd voted for Marine Le Pen's father in 2002, but he disappointed them and they've drifted off to vote for Marine Le Pen, and they will see him very much as, you know, he does have to overcome the sort of weight around his neck of having had a go at this once before.
Well, Dr. Smith, thank you very much for your time today.
Well, thank you.
Broadcasting from Edinburgh, Scotland, you're listening to World in Focus on Radio Sputnik
with Jack Foster and Carolyn Scott. Welcome back. Still to come on today's programme, EU finance and economy ministers are currently meeting in Brussels to discuss upcoming EU budgets, but an agreement at the midterm review looks like a tough task, given growing discontent from countries such as Italy and Greece over the ongoing austerity measures.
Peru is now midway through its hosting of the annual APEC summit, and with talks reportedly taking place between Lima and Beijing over the long-anticipated RCEP partnership, we will be looking at the future of free trade in the Asia-Pacific, now that the US is sounding more and more like it's going to step back from such treaties in the wake of Donald Trump's victory.
Kenyan officials have today announced that they will extend the closure of the Dadaab refugee camp by 6 months, but human rights groups are reporting that Kenyan officials are forcing refugees out of the world's largest refugee camp in attempts to speed up repatriation programmes.
Former British Prime Minister David Cameron may not have a full-time income at the moment, but he's unlikely to find himself facing financial hardship anytime soon. It's emerged this week that he's receiving £130,000 per hour for delivering speeches about Brexit.
And great art is always controversial. That is the statement of a man who spent 7 hours getting a tattoo of a rather controversial figure's face. EU finance and economy ministers are currently meeting in Brussels to discuss the upcoming EU budget reforms. In September, the European Commission proposed that a mid-term review of the budget should include a boost in spending for jobs, growth, migration and security. In other words, a loosening of the austerity-dominated approach that prevailed since 2008, which some countries argue is stifling their economic growth.
However, a number of countries still aren't happy with this, especially Italy, whose Prime Minister Matteo Renzi has called for more concrete spending measures and in the process has positioned himself as being ideologically opposed to Germany and some other Northern European members. In order for the proposed changes to be made at the midterm review of the budget, the Commission must come to an agreement at summit by midnight tomorrow. Negotiations are expected to run through the night and right up to tomorrow's midnight deadline.
Failing an agreement during the summit, there would be one final chance to create a new proposal, which would have to be negotiated by mid-December, the last legal deadline set by the final plenary sitting of the European Parliament this year. Joining me on the line is Professor Ian Begg from the European Institute, London School of Economics and Political Science. Professor Begg, EU finance and economy ministers meeting in Brussels right now. Do you think it's plausible, that we will see an agreement by the end of tomorrow? What do you think might happen?
I think it's unlikely that an agreement that changes much would be possible by the end of tomorrow, because the EU budget is set in a 7-year framework and unpicking it is a monumental task. All we'll see is changes at the margins.
We've seen quite a division open up between countries such as Italy and Greece, and then who've called for more public spending, and those who prefer tighter fiscal controls such as Germany. Do you think that we'll see these member states agree to more public spending?
It's possible that there'll be some agreement to pay for what are relatively inexpensive components of the budget, such as additional support for border control. But you're not going to see big changes in the things that are the most costly elements of the EU budget, such as agricultural policy or the local economic development, what's called cohesion policy in EU speak, because they are so difficult to negotiate that no country is going to give up what it already has. And all they can do is use the spare in some of the budget headings to try to mollify the likes of Matteo Renzi from Italy, who wants more on border control.
And you say Renzi there, Italy has argued that more spending would boost growth, and other members are suggesting that taking on more debt is a big risk. Now, do you think that this the spending that Renzi wants could actually help some of the EU's more sluggish economies?
I think there's a misconception here, which is that the EU budget is not allowed to borrow. It has to match its revenue with its expenditure. And the revenue that the EU budget obtains comes from individual countries. Therefore, if the EU spends more, it's because the national treasuries have to put more money into it. And that necessarily takes money away from them. So there's no net difference in the spending. Anyone who believes this is spending that will boost growth is misunderstanding how the EU budget works.
As you said, this is a very complex issue, trying to unravel the entire EU budget. It's a very big thing that comes up only every 7 years. Now, if no deal can be made over the next few days, and if we continue to see divisions between the likes of Italy and Greece and Germany, then what do you think the Commission's approach will be to budgets like this?
Well, this is the midterm review of a 7-year budget. And as a midterm review, it's only really allowed to make marginal adjustments. If nothing can be agreed on the midterm review, then it just simply reverts to what was in place beforehand. So in that sense, it's status quo. What it can do is to affect the next annual budget, which will be obviously for 2017, where there might be some scope for saying spend a little bit more on X and a little bit less on Y, where X could be support for refugees, support for border control, and Y could be trying to reduce some of the current spending on economic development projects, which are slow to take off. But it's that second order of change is the most you're likely to get.
And just finally, do you think that in some regards the leaders of member states play politics with this a little bit? I mean, Renzi is facing what could be a disastrous referendum in the coming weeks. He needs something to go back to say that he is fighting for Italy here in the EU budget. Is there an element of that in this?
Perish the thought that anybody at EU level could be play politics when they're politicians. Of course that's what they're doing. There's always a strong motivation for politicians to go to Brussels and then come home and say, I won a victory.
Professor Beck, thank you very much for speaking to us today.
This year's annual week-long APEC summit is at its halfway point today as news emerges of talks between the host nation Peru and China on the possibility of joining the Beijing-led RCEP trade pact. This is, of course, all particularly significant given the now unpredictable status of the US-led TPP deal following the election of Donald Trump last week. Now, for listeners who tend to get a little bamboozled by all the different trade deals, and I know I'm guilty of it from time to time, and what they mean, here is a quick reminder.
APEC stands for Asia-Pacific Economic Cooperation, and it's a free trade agreement with 21 members in the Asia-Pacific region, including China, Russia, the US and Canada.
TPP is the Trans-Pacific Partnership, and it's pretty similar to APEC, except that it notably excludes major economies like China, India and Russia.
The RCEP stands for Regional Comprehensive Economic Partnership, and it's the one that Peru and China have been having discussions about this week. As yet, it doesn't actually exist. It's still just a proposal. It's largely seen as an alternative to the TPP agreement in that it includes China and India.
Many Asia-Pacific economies are now looking for alternatives to the US-led trade deals in the wake of Donald Trump's presidential win, which looks likely to usher in a more protectionist, isolationist economic position from Washington. Commentators are, of course, claiming that Trump is likely to backpedal on his pledges regarding international trade deals, but if we listen to a clip from a debate last year, he was pretty emphatic.
The TPP is a horrible deal. It is a deal that is going to lead to nothing but trouble. It's a deal that was designed for China to come in, as they always do, through the back door and totally take advantage of everyone. It's 5,600 pages long, so complex that nobody's read it. This is one of the worst trade deals, and I would, yes, rather not have it.
US President-elect Donald Trump speaking during a debate last year there. Now, both the Trans-Pacific Partnership and APEC have very little in the way of ties with Latin American countries. Both include Peru and Chile, but that's as far as it goes.
As it stands, the proposed RCEP deal looks set to be even less concerned with Latin America than TPP or APEC. It as it is currently focused on the 10 member states of the Association of Southeast Asian Nations, although that could well change, and this week's discussions between Beijing and Lima may just mark the beginnings of that expansion. Such moves would certainly be in line with the aspirations of Peru's recently elected president, Pedro Pablo Kuczynski, who has already stated a need to embrace South American nations in the formation of future trade agreements.
The whole world is not just Europe and the pivot to Asia. Think about Latin America. We're next door, 3,000 miles away, but we're still kind of next door. And the Latins, despite what Donald Trump says, have helped the U.S.
Peru's President Pedro Pablo Kuczynski speaking there in September. So, from Peru's perspective, the hope is that the Trans-Pacific Partnership with the US will remain in place and that the still non-existent Regional Comprehensive Economic Partnership could exist alongside it, which is not a particularly crazy idea, but the real question mark is over TPP right now. Regardless of the many, many suggestions that Donald Trump will furiously backpedal on much of his protectionist rhetoric.
Dr. Biswajit Dar is a professor of economics at Jawaharlal Nehru University, and he joins me now on the line from New Delhi. Thanks for coming on the program today, Dr. Dar. Is there really a future for TPP in its current form?
No, I think one thing that Donald Trump has made abundantly clear is that the trade deals that have been done, NAFTA and the TPP, both are unacceptable to him. So he would like to, my reading is that he would not junk them, but he would renegotiate them. He has put forth the sole argument that these trade deals have not benefited the American workers. So he would like to renegotiate these two deals. Now, my view is that renegotiating TPP will be extremely difficult because it was a finely balanced deal and it took a long time for different countries to sort of have their say in what was a U.S.-led process. So I am rather skeptical that other countries involved in TPP would allow the TPP to be open. So that in effect means that TPP will have a very serious problem going forward.
In the sense that there are obviously lots of these trade pacts that now exist specifically in Asia Pacific region, how important now, given the fact that there are these other deals and more deals on the horizon, how important is a trade deal that the US is at the center of?
It is very important because US really wants to have its big say in this region, which is increasingly becoming the fulcrum of the global economy. And, so his whole idea that US will be a major player through the TPP, that remains absolutely significant for the United States, I think. Now, whether Donald Trump accepts it or not, that's another issue.
As you say, it's obviously significant for the United States. How significant is it for the rest of the region?
Oh, it is very important. I think one is, of course, the Regional Comprehensive Economic Partnership is coming together. The way the ASEAN proposed the RCEP, because RCEP is basically, grew out of the ASEAN summit process. ASEAN wanted this regional formation to be what we call open regionalism, in the sense that there will be initially some countries who would be negotiating a deal, but it will not remain restricted to only these countries. There will be possibilities of other countries also joining in. So, membership in a way would be open to other countries joining in. So I think the countries which are involved in the RCEP negotiations, mindful of the fact that this kind of a framework is very important for this region. And I think going forward, this formation is going to get important. Of course, there are some issues to be sorted out between the 16 countries negotiating RCEP.
Just lastly, obviously these deals are as much about politics as they are about trade, especially given the current climate in Washington following the Trump victory. Would it be overstating the situation to assume that this is quite a pivotal moment in terms of global power? If the US is making noises about pulling back from these big free trade agreements, is this now about which other world powers are going to try to fill that void?
No, it is absolutely important because TPP was, in one sense, becoming US's formation, which would challenge the supremacy of China. in this region. And, you know, in the 2 years back, China, when it was hosting the APEC summit in Beijing, had proposed a work program for an Asia for a free trade agreement within the ASEAN APEC membership. They called it FTAP, Free Trade Area of Asia Pacific. And that was seen as a counter to the TPP. Now, if the TPP ceases to exist, then I think that China will take more interest in maybe RCEP, or maybe it will try to push, you know, the idea of FTAP within APEC and try to fill that gap. And, you know, earlier there were a lot of other countries in the ASEAN which were completely opposed to China. Now, Philippines is warming up, and who knows, tomorrow the situation might change for China to actually assume a pivotal role in this region.
Dr. Biswajit Dar, thank you very much for talking to us.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Human rights group Amnesty International have today highlighted the plight of refugees at Kenya's Dadaab refugee camp. Dadaab camp is the world's largest refugee camp, hosting more than 280,000 refugees, primarily from neighbouring Somalia.
In May of this year, Kenyan authorities announced that the refugee camp would be closed in November and sped up the repatriation programme. Back in September, we reported on comments by Human Rights Watch on what they called the worrying implications of the repatriation programme. They believe that the programme used misinformation and cash incentives to force Somali refugees to return to incredibly dangerous regions in their home nation.
Today, Amnesty International reports that Kenyan government officials are, quote, deliberately forcing refugees to return to Somalia, where they risk being injured or killed in the ongoing armed conflict. Since the release of the report this morning, Kenyan officials have agreed to extend the closing date of the camp for 6 months. But there still remains a great deal of uncertainty over what will happen to the hundreds of thousands of refugees who are unable to return to their homes due to the decades-long armed conflict that continues across Somalia.
Karanisa Dalla from Amnesty International joins me on the line. Thank you for joining us today. We previously heard similar reports to this back in September, and the United Nations Human Refugee Agency were implicated in failing to provide reliable information to refugees in Dadaab, who were then being forced to return to Somalia. So are these reports still widespread and prevalent then among refugees even now?
Yes, the situation hasn't really changed for refugees in Dadaab. Today, the Ministry of Interior in Kenya made a statement saying that they would extend the camp closure date for another 6 months, but they're still intending to, according to the statement at least, they're still intending to close the camp, and they want Somalis to continue returning to Somalia. They haven't indicated that they will allow them to continue to stay in Kenya, whether in Dadaab camp or elsewhere. So refugees have been left in quite a difficult situation. Many of the people that we've spoken to are extremely anxious about what will happen. And the majority don't want to return to Somalia.
And Amnesty has already interviewed many refugees who did try to return to Somalia and then had to flee back to Dadaab, and I believe received some quite horrendous and harrowing accounts of what refugees face when they do indeed try to return. Is that correct?
Yes, I spoke to several refugees in Dadaab who'd returned to Somalia in 2015 and early 2016, and all their stories are extremely harrowing. Two boys that we spoke to, aged 15 and 18, they'd returned to Somalia with their family in early 2016. They had seen their father killed in front of them. They were forcibly recruited by the armed group Al-Shabaab and then eventually managed to escape and come back to Dadaab, but they don't know where the rest of their family members are. And there are other stories of people who went back and who used all the money that had been given to them by UNHCR to try and start their lives up again in Somalia, only to have them destroyed, have their homes destroyed, have their livelihoods taken away from them because of the ongoing armed conflict there. And that's something that the Kenyan authorities and the international community need to bear in mind when they talk about return to Somalia. There is an ongoing armed conflict in the country. There's very limited resources, and for the areas that are considered safe to return to, there's lack of basic services, lack of access to education, lack of access to healthcare. So people returning are really struggling to cope there.
As you say, the situation in Somalia is not a good one. The south and central areas are still very volatile and unsafe. But as well as that, there's also drought, I believe, and a lack of humanitarian aid. And Somalia itself already has over 1 million internally displaced people. So even given 6 more months with the Dadaab camp, is that going to be anywhere near enough time to try and at least make some areas safe for people to return to?
6 months isn't a very long time, and Somalia has been in conflict for decades now. The humanitarian appeal, the UN humanitarian appeal, is still underfunded in Somalia. And there's large parts of the country are controlled by armed groups, including Al-Shabaab. So it would be extremely difficult to be able to provide all those resources and to provide for over 1 million internally displaced people, as you say, in the next 6 months, so that the environment is conducive for more people to return to.
Mm-hmm. And what exactly are the international community doing to help here? Because I imagine that if the Dadaab camp closes and people think that Somalia is too unsafe to return to, then many must surely be thinking that one of the options would be to take the incredibly unsafe trip across the Mediterranean, which has taken thousands of lives this year. I mean, what can the international community be doing to try and tackle these issues?
The international community so far has provided very limited support to Kenya, which hosts over 500,000 refugees. And that's part of the reason that the Kenyan government has given for wanting to close the Dadaab refugee camp. They've said that they feel that they've been shouldering the burden for over 2 decades now, and the support from donors has been very limited. So one thing that the international community can certainly do is provide more support to Kenya and to look at longer-term solutions, to work with Kenya to find longer-term solutions to hosting refugees, because hosting them in camps isn't a long-term solution. And some people that have lived in Dadaab have been there for 25 years or have been born there and have no other options for livelihoods or for being integrated into the local communities. So donors can certainly help with that, working with Kenya for that and to ensure that their appeals, the UN humanitarian appeals, are fully funded. And the other area that the international community can work with Kenya on is to increase the number of resettlement places for the most vulnerable refugees to be able to leave Kenya.
Well, Karen Isadala, thank you very much for speaking to us today.
Thank you.
The former British Prime Minister David Cameron is earning £130,000 per hour giving speeches about Brexit, it's emerged. Cameron stood down as Prime Minister after losing the EU referendum in June, and he subsequently resigned as MP for Witney in September. He's kept a very low profile since then, but it now seems like he's earning a pretty penny on the speaking circuit.
David Cameron does not need to seek approval for the one-off engagements from the Advisory Committee on Business Appointments. This requires former ministers to get permission only for regular jobs. For more on this, I'm now joined by Liam O'Hare. Liam, what do we know about what David Cameron's been up to?
Brexit, of course, cost David Cameron the keys to number 10, and he had campaigned vigorously for a vote to remain, and ultimately gambled his political future on the outcome of that result. Now, that gamble didn't pay off, but the referendum defeat appears to have opened the door to a very lucrative new career for Mr Cameron. What we do know is the former Prime Minister has earned a six-figure sum for speaking at Wall Street firm Blackstone Properties in New York last week. Now, last month, Cameron was also believed to have earned a similar amount for another speech about Brexit for private equity firm Bain Capital. Now, the fact that he's earned over £100,000 for these speeches is really quite astonishing. To put that in perspective, in just over 1 hour, he would earn more than he did in one whole year as Prime Minister of the UK. Or to look at it another way, the sum equates to over £2,000 per minute of speech. So we're talking about quite incredible amounts of money here. But of course, this isn't the first time that David Cameron's financial dealings have caused controversy. After the release of the Panama Papers earlier this year, Cameron was forced to admit profiting from an offshore trust fund owned by his own father. Now, at that time, he was Prime Minister. So this is unlikely to make quite as many headlines.
David Cameron's not the first former leader to go down the lucrative speaking fee path, though, is he?
No, of course he's not. And some might, you only need to look back to another former British Prime Minister, Mr. Tony Blair, to find someone who's went down that very same road. Now, Blair embarked on a lucrative business career since leaving office in 2005 and is now said to be worth up to £60 million, Carolyn. So quite significant amounts of money in the Blair bank balance there. So his fortunes have risen from various sources, including property, personal business, and indeed consultancy fees. Now, this caused a lot of controversy because these include millions of pounds taken from countries accused of grave human rights abuses. But even in perspective of the amount of money that Tony Blair's raised, fees for former premiers are believed to have been even higher in the United States. Bill Clinton, for instance, once earned over $16 million in just 1 year for a variety of speeches that he made. So these are really serious figures we're talking about, but ultimately the fees earned by Bill and Hillary Clinton did come back to bite them during the recent US presidential election. They were used as a tool to attack Hillary Clinton and paint her as corrupt, or as Donald Trump said, crooked. Now, I'm not sure if Tony Blair or indeed David Cameron are planning a return to politics anytime soon. It might not prove the most popular of moves, but if they do, you can be sure the spotlight will be on the lucrative amounts of money that they've earned from these speaking engagements.
Well, thank you, Liam O'Hare. And if only there was a great demand for Scottish radio presenters to give after-dinner speeches, eh?
Indeed. We can but hope.
Broadcasting from Edinburgh, Scotland, you're listening to World in Focus on Radio Sputnik
with Jack Foster and Carolyn Scott. Welcome back. Still to come on today's programme, Turkey-Israel relations have markedly improved this week as both countries appoint new ambassadors. We take a look at the history of the somewhat bumpy relations between both countries and ask what the wider implications of their diplomatic reunification could be.
A new poll shows that 72% of Brits believe that social media groups such as Facebook should have to take responsibility to prevent the spread of misinformation or fake news. This follows allegations that the spread of fake news stories is having a huge influence on political campaigns and elections.
And great art is always controversial,
so
or at
they
least
say.
That is the excuse given by one man who got a rather controversial tattoo.
Israel and Turkey appear to have completed their journey to the normalisation of bilateral relations this week by mutually appointing new ambassadors. Yesterday, Israel announced that it would be sending Eitan Ney, a former Israeli ambassador, to Turkey, who currently works as the deputy head of the Israeli embassy in London.
Reciprocating this move, Turkish President Erdogan confirmed today that one of the Turkish Prime Minister's foreign policy advisers had been appointed as Turkey's ambassador to Israel. While the acceptance of both appointments are yet to be confirmed by Ankara and Tel Aviv, it appears that both countries are keen to break out of the diplomatic stalemate that has defined bilateral relations for the past 6 years.
The process of normalising relations began in 2013 after Erdogan and Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu held a phone call aimed at assuaging tense relations. Negotiations have since picked up in pace, with an Israeli delegation visiting Turkey late last year. But what caused the souring of relations in the first place? Well, earlier on, I put that question to Sputnik's Matthew Aiton.
So Israel-Turkey relations have been stuck in the quagmire now for 6 years, and the reason for this can be traced back to events that occurred on the 31st of May 2010. Concerned that a humanitarian crisis was occurring in Gaza as a result of Israel's land, air and sea blockade, in May 2010 the Free Gaza Movement dispatched a flotilla of ships known as the Peace Flotilla, which all in all comprised of about 8 vessels, and they had the express intention of violating Israel's naval blockade and delivering humanitarian aid, such as food and medicine, to the people of the besieged Palestinian coastal enclave. Israel allegedly advised the flotilla to either turn back or dock at the nearby Israeli port so as to allow their cargo to be inspected. The flotilla actually rejected the offer, arguing that they were in international waters, which was true, thus had no obligation under international law of the high seas to abide by Israel's demands, and that their only intention was to sail to Gaza in order to deliver humanitarian relief. This is where things got rather ugly. Israel was successful in enforcing its blockade on all of the ships bar one, the Mavi Marmara, which refused to cooperate. Israeli forces, I think, attempted to board the Mavi by using boats, but they were easily repelled by the Mavi's crew. In response, Israeli army helicopters began firing stun grenades and live ammunition on the Mavi and its crew, and eventually Israeli commandos managed to descend upon the vessel. A UN report on the incident documents that it was difficult for investigative teams to figure out exactly what ensued next. But what is sure is that a fight broke out between crew members and Israeli forces, which culminated in the death of 9 passengers and the wounding of at least 50 others. The report also determines that at least 4 of the passengers who were killed did not pose any threat to the Israeli forces, all of whom were shot by the commandos, by the way. Subsequently, there was a lot of talk that Israel had broken international law because the vessel, as I said, was in international waters, and the activists aboard were unarmed or had at their disposal rudimentary weapons like bats. Anyway, following the incident, tens of thousands of Turks protested outside the Israeli embassy and in the famous Taksim Square in central Istanbul, with some even trying to storm the embassy. Turkey also pulled out its ambassadors from Tel Aviv, and bilateral relations remained stagnant until 2013, when Netanyahu and Erdogan held a phone call to try and assuage relations.
So how then could the normalization of relations between both these states affect the geopolitical landscape of the region, would you say?
Well, the Mavi Marmara incident had major geopolitical ramifications for both states, who were once very close regional allies, actually, and even engaged in joint military training. One of the parties to benefit from the diplomatic quarrel most of all was probably the Palestinian Hamas, who have seen a spike in Turkish patronage since the incident, receiving hundreds of thousands, some reports even suggest millions of dollars in aid from Turkey. Following this latest attempt at reconciliation, I think the most interesting development will be in the Palestinian territories, especially regarding Hamas in Gaza. As I said, Erdogan has acted, along with Iran, as a major Hamas patron since the Mavi Marmara incident. So the normalization of relations between one of its major backers, its enemy, is unlikely to have a positive ring on the ground in Gaza, I'd imagine. However, there have not been any signs that Ankara is going to abandon its position of calling upon Israel to lift the Gaza blockade. In fact, as part of a deal made between Turkey and Israel in June this year, as part of reconciliation, Turkey is allowed to deliver a 10,000-ton shipment of humanitarian aid and build a hospital with a capacity to hold 200 beds, in addition to funding for the establishment of, I think, a new power station and a water purification unit, which are welcome developments in Gaza. Hamas has, however, been keen to show that it will tolerate Turkey's deal with Israel. For example, in July, it gave a statement thanking Erdogan and Turkey for efforts to help ease the suffering of Palestinians in Gaza. There are those who are saying that Turkey's renewed relationship with Israel might mean that Hamas will have to manage its relations with Ankara through a kind of back door, and that while the Islamist group wants to avoid angering Turkey, the truth is that it's fast running out of allies and risks falling into complete isolation. I mean, after all, its other patron Iran has been reined in on its funding for Hamas by the nuclear deal with the United States. All of this, of course, can only be good news for Israel, that has been yearning to see an incapacitated Hamas. As for wider regional issues, both sides, that is Israel and Turkey, are steadfastly determined to see the downfall of Bashar al-Assad. And it's known that Turkey has overtly and argued that Israel is covertly aiding elements of the opposition to try and hasten Syria into the future without him. Turkey also has, for the most part, maintained strong relations with the Gulf monarchies. And I wouldn't like to crystal ball gaze too much, but if all goes well for Turkish-Israel relations, I think that this may serve Israel well as it continues to try and bring its unspoken friendly relationship, like Saudi Arabia, out of the political closet and into the daylight. But of course, all of this depends upon how well Israel-Turkey relations unfold from here.
Matthew Aiton, thank you.
From the moment you turn on your phone, you see what friends are sharing. Your latest messages, calls, and updates are right up front.
The soothing, friendly, trustworthy sound of a recent Facebook commercial there. But Facebook's trustworthiness has been thrown into the spotlight recently over the growing phenomenon of fake news.
Yes, it seems that 72% of Brits believe that social media companies like Facebook should have to take responsibility to prevent their platforms being used to spread misinformation. That's according to a new poll by YouGov. In the light of the US elections and the Brexit referendum, the social media giant has been facing down allegations that the spread of supposedly fake news stories on its site influenced the election of President-elect Donald Trump.
Sputnik's Nima Green has been following this story today, and she joins me on the line now from London. Nima, why are people targeting Facebook in particular over fake news, and how really can social media platforms like Facebook police fake news?
Well, essentially last Saturday, CEO Mark Zuckerberg was forced to defend Facebook from accusations that fake news on his site influenced the US election. And he's insisting that 99% of news links shared on his site is legitimate. But as ever, the devil is in the detail, and you just need to look at the US election this year to see it was amazingly close. And 99% may sound like a reasonable expectation, but even if 1% of the fake news stories that were shared on his site were fake, that's a huge volume that could have reached millions of people. And also consider the users themselves. If you look back to 2015, there was a Pew Research study that found that 61% of American millennials were using Facebook as their most common source of political news. And that's 17 points higher than what was the next source, which is CNN. So that would mean that for millions of people, Facebook is not just about sharing personal information, it's also a legitimate news source. That follows that you have to extend Zuckerberg's defense to other news sources. And imagine if, say, the New York Times or the Guardian tried to deflect criticism of their journalism with a line like, you know, don't worry, guys, only 1% of our work is fabricated. There's no way that that would fly. And therein lies the problem for Facebook. They're, to some extent, being accused of being disingenuous to some extent of what purpose their site serves for people today. And with greater expectations from users, it's inevitable there'll be greater scrutiny.
What then is the way forward for Facebook? I mean, how can it realistically tackle this phenomenon of fake news?
There are key difficulties, firstly, for platforms not just like Facebook, but also Google. Facebook itself uses an algorithm to promote its news sources to users, and it's the simple fact that 80% of their revenue comes through ads. So the more we share, the more they earn. So Facebook engineers are saying that it's important because it helps people to have a more targeted Facebook experience. But the way forward would be, there's two key ways. They could take the option like Google News has done and go through a route of more sophisticated vetting algorithms. In October, Google News started attaching a fact-check label to dubious stories and then linking that to trusted sites that debunk those stories. And this is all achieved by an algorithm. Or they could go down the human route, and Facebook has already experimented with this with human moderators for trending stories, but they were forced to scrap that project because moderators were accused of favoring liberal-leaning stories over pro-Trump material. But that was just Facebook staff and not journalists, not editors. And some say that Facebook must now accept responsibility that they are a news source, like that Pew study from last year suggested, and therefore hire experienced editors to vet their stories. And certainly yesterday's this new YouGov poll is indicating in the UK at least there is strong public support for greater responsibility of this kind.
Well, the moral of the story, I suppose, then, not to believe everything we read on Facebook. Nima Green, thank you very much for talking to us.
And finally, great art is always controversial, is the line of defence taken by British man Dave Singleton following some criticism regarding his new tattoo. The tattoo covers his entire lower leg. It features Donald Trump's face and the slogan, "In Trump, we trust."
Got to be a pretty big fan of Donald Trump to go for that. And he's not even American.
No, he's British, and he apparently is quite a fan. He says that there are some things he disagrees with, though, but he thinks Clinton's been in the establishment too long, and so Trump is the man to turn it all around.
And so, obviously, he got his face tattooed in his leg.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm not an expert, but 7 hours seems like a very long time to be getting a tattoo. Do you think that at some point during that, maybe he had a moment of clarity where he thought, not sure if this was the right idea?
Nope, he seems exceptionally happy with his choice. He did say that, well, he must, though, be really hoping that Donald Trump doesn't do anything stupid over the next few years.
Fingers crossed. But Carolyn, of course, does have a World in Focus tattoo
of
as well
course.
On her leg.
Uh-huh, yeah. Not with your face on it, Jack.
No, I suggested that, but she wasn't going for it.
That is all we have time for on this edition of World in Focus. Don't forget, you can listen again to this and previous shows at sputniknews.com/radio.
This is Radio Sputnik in Edinburgh. In a moment, we will go over to Washington, D.C. for the Tom Hartman Show. Until tomorrow, from me, Jack Foster.
Me, Carolyn Scott.
Goodbye.